Mr. Scott, Reel 13. You say, Mr. Scott, that having done some misdemeanour against the Germans, which annoyed them, you were sent to a civilian prison. Why was that?
Well, this was the usual place that POWs were sent to due to lack of accommodation in the camp itself, the castle itself. It was also regarded as a bit of a bonus because when one was restricted in living quarters with other POWs, it could get very trying. And the freedom of going out of the camp, from our point of view, was a bit of a bonus. But the Germans liked us out of the camp so that no further trouble would be caused in light of the circumstances we, myself and other POWs, were involved.
What kind of misdemeanor would you perpetrate to warrant being in this kind of situation?
Usually one of the German guards would be counting. And there were four appels a day, there were four checks a day, which is more than any camp anywhere. And when he got to about 15 people, he was rather simple. So then he'd say 15, 20, 21, 22, 30. And he'd get all the numbers wrong and have to go back to the start. Everybody would cheer him like mad. And then the officer would come along, taking a parade, and start picking people out, telling them not to be stupid. And it was really a sort of, what you might call a rag. But with a little bit of serious overtones, because I got very annoyed in the end, and of course, I walked you out.
Did this keep your morale up? Was it a morale raising?
Oh, yes, very much so, yes. It was, we used to go on parade at 8:30 in the morning. Dressed like nothing on earth, most of us. Some of the officers are very spick and span, and always would be because they were that tight, and others came down unshaven, undressed, and a mess. And the Germans didn't mind as long as the numbers were right. And of course, coupled to that was the fact that we had a couple of ghosts who were working in tunnels and things, and we had two dummies made up to look like POWs and being carried between two POWs on parade, so they count 15, 16, 17, and one of them, the 16, would be a fake. They got onto that in the end, but it was a good laugh and a great fun building it. I wasn't involved myself in it, but it was a means of relieving the tensions a bit and trying to put one over on the Germans.
Was there any right of appeal against any?
Yes, there was.
The Germans said obviously we're going to punish someone. Was there a right of appeal against that?
Not really. They had the whip hand, and they were. I think one could say that they were fair. They must have got very annoyed at one time. This continual, I mean, you imagine. 130 British officers all queued up to get out. It was aggravating for the Germans because they doubled the guard. They put two guards on for each prisoner, which is the highest known in Germany.
What is the quality of the guards at this stage? Because we're basically talking about the last few months of the war.
Well, they're all what I would have done. Fairly senior home guard people, that type. Chaps who were possibly had been wounded and had come back into service. But the older generation, and generally not soldiers. They wore the uniform and they had the gun, but they were good enough if anybody tried to get over the wire and it had happened. They'd shoot. I mean, there's no bones about that. So that there's a tight. And then, of course, there were felt labels and corporals and sergeants and under officers, all capable of being extremely high-handed and naughty.
Do you recall the name of the German commandant at this time?
Yes, I've got his name written down. Pervit. I'll try and give you
that the guards got friendlier, or did they distance themselves from you even more so? They must have got some idea of what was coming to an end.
I don't know whether I've done this before, but the amazing thing to me, and to a lot of our prisoners, was that the Germans, right up to the last few days, were convinced that Hitler had a war winner, should I put it that way, something which was going to win the war for him. And yet the whole thing was falling apart, the big raids on Dresden, the British bombers and American bombers all over the country. And still, a lot of them would say, oh, but he's got something. And of course, they were right in a way. They had the V1, V2, and then the atomic bomb. And they this is a sort of talk, you know, back room talk, but they weren't far off the mark. And if they'd had this Pedemundi business, as far as I understand, where they had heavy water and all these things to make up the bomb and had dropped it, I think that would have been the end of the war in Europe. That's my own opinion. I might be a bit wrong.
Did this confidence that they had right up to the last minute, did that in any way put any doubts into your mind that things may not be as good as they were appearing to be?
Well, no, I think we realised things were pretty good, but we always had the feeling in the back of our mind, having been there 5 years, not at Kolditz, but in general, some of them had 5 years in Kolditz, which is a long stint. There was always just this worry that things might go wrong and we hadn't got any way to get out or get away or anything. And our actual removal, which I'll come to a little later, was absolutely astounding. When told or understood how it happened, it's incredible.
We can probably pick up now on your go back to your illness and your hospitalisation.
I think I made the comment that it was jolly nice to get back to Kolditz, and that I feel was quite sure. It was a terrible place at Wurzeln. But the thing that amazed me was I was informed that the Swiss Red Cross had notified my mother and father in England that my operation had been successful. And I was absolutely amazed that that happened, and thankful, of course. And when I returned home after the war, I went to the Red Cross headquarters in Birmingham and thanked the Red Cross personnel for the sort of attitude and the way they did everything. Well, I mean, all Red Cross were marvellous. You escaped there. They took you into Switzerland, they gave you a job in the embassy or something, but it's more than that, it was caring.
How often did the Red Cross visit the camps? Was there a period of time?
Well, I think there was an official sort of period of time, but we all knew when they were coming, because the Germans would say, well, they're coming, and they're smarting the place up now, boys, you know, don't let the side down, even though we're within them. And of course, a lot of discussions must have gone on, which I wouldn't have been privy to, or anybody in my rank. It just been senior officers, colonels, and people. But on the whole, the Germans glossed over the food rationing, for instance, the lack of parcels coming through. Even the coders, the big gaps, when it comes to parcels, and they were getting lifted, I think, by some down way. But on the main, they were a wonderful support to prisoners because they were always there and they came around and talked to you and met you and, you know.
Did they talk to you without Germans being present?
Not really, no. It was generally a little group, you know, and everybody said that's fine. And we said that the Russians non-existent and the food's lousy. But they took that in a good part. And the Germans were pleased to see the last of them as a way, as we were. Well, not the last one, but they were really good.
So you came back to Kolditz after your operation.
Yes.
What physical condition were you in at this stage?
Well, I was put in the MI room, medical room, which was one or two beds, if I remember rightly. and to try and get my wound to heal up. It took a long time, like a fool. But eventually I surfaced and got back with the friends I had. And I think that I was really pleased to be back amongst my own, you know, because the hospital at Wurt was a shocker. So I can go on from there. Is there anything else?
No, please go on.
I'm just looking. Must be through.
Can you talk me through what a typical day of your life in Colnitz, Mr. Scott?
Yes, I think so. And there's so many similar ones that I think I'd really nail them up. I generally got up for a parade, which was called at 8:30 in the morning. Some people dress properly and others not. There's some ragamuffins amongst them. Some of the officers were well turned out and keen to look their best.
Where did you fall in this particular?
Well, it was a random way. I wasn't prudish about it. I put a greatcoat on or whatever I had, and I turned up reasonably well. I was rather subject to accepting cold baths in the morning. I found that was stimulating, and we had about 3 or 4 big tub baths. And you could go in there any time, and it was arranged with the dormitory. And in the summer, of course, with the hot weather, one was to play a game of whatever in the courtyard, and then have a good splash and clean up.
What time was Revali? What time did you get it? Was some kind of signal that everyone got at the same time?
Yes. Oh, yes, everybody was up. But you see, I'm talking now, I've got to put it into context, and I must go back to the camp, the council. At Colnitz consisted originally, I'm talking the early days, of two to 300 French, 60 to 90 British, Poles 40 to 100, Belgians 40, Dutch 60. And there were 4 appels a day, which was very trying. You had to turn out and stand on the way and get counted, and that's when all the larking around went on. I say larking around, it could be quite serious, of course. So that really was the contingent. Now the Germans, I'm going off now, not off, wondering, the Germans decided that they'd to kick out all the Poles, all these troublemakers, the great fighters, all the French, all the Dutch, all the Belgians, and even the British, and the few key people. Now moving into the key position. We had the American colonel, Colonel, I think they called him General, I'm sorry. Colonel Duke, and a fellow called Schwartz, I think his name was, an American, again a parish. We had General Paul Komorowski, who was the underground leader in Warsaw, and a fine gentleman. He brought his staff with him, about 20. We had
they must have been brought out before the Russians got into Warsaw.
They were, yes. Yes, they came back.
They brought them back out of there.
Yes. And there's a nice little story, and I can't vouch for it, but it was current at the time, that General Volkanovsky was offered by Hitler to release him and his staff from Colnitz and let them go back to Warsaw to fight the Russians. With their prison being
Polish prisoners.
Yes. Just let them go. And of course he got an answer no. Now this, whether it's a story or whether it's I don't know, it was quite prevalent when we were there. I have some notes, best way to put this, that the general life of living in close community was to feel at the end of the day, which was the question you were asking. Your first priority, at least my priority, was what staging was to be done. But by this time, during the war, things had really gone down to nil. There was nobody except Miller. There was a lot of people were due for repatriation, and the German colonel didn't accept repatriation for them until the very last moment. Did I mention Mickey Wynn? Oh, well, here we go. Well, I'd have to tell you a story on this, because it's quite amazing. When we received new prisoners, British prisoners, our own chaps, into the camp, they were all vetted, of course, pretty intensively by senior officers, not my sort of level, but I saw it all.
Senior British officers, better.
Yes, oh yes.
This would be in case of any
plants
in the mountain.
Yes, yes. And one chap who I got to know quite well was a fellow called Mickey Wynn. And he'd been on the Sanders Air motor torpedo boat race run from the naval MTBs. And he suffered a bad back and he couldn't walk properly. And amongst others, I used to give him a hand around the courtyard. Well, this went on and he applied for repatriation and applied for it, and then he gave it to me and tried every trick of the book. But as a little side point, at the end of the war, I had a letter from him. And he said, "Dear Mike," he said, "I hate to tell you this, but there's never anything the matter with me at all. It was a put-out job." And another side light on that was, he is now Lord Newborough, quite an aristocratic person, and a charming man, I may say, hell of a good chap. And when we had the 40th anniversary dinner in London, which our wives were included, he spoke to my wife, I introduced him to my wife, and he said to her, I did a trick, and he repeated this story, but he didn't remember. The reason for him trying to get repatriated was that we got a lot of Permanente in the camp.
About what time were these people arriving?
Possibly 6 months, spent, not all at the same time.
Before the end of the war?
Before the war, oh yes, yes. So we gathered, see if I can get it off my head. There was the Master of Elphinstone, who was a Queen's Navy. There was Lord Linlithgow, Viceroy of India's son. Charlie Hopeton, actually, as we knew him. There was John Wyland, the American's ambassador's son. There's Earl Haig. Somebody else.
Why had they transferred these people to Colitz?
As hostages, we think, for the German High Command. In fact, the big problem was that Colonel Todd, who was our commander, senior officer, a fine man, a strong-minded, and he was asked by the, or told by the Dresden general in charge of that district, that they were to move out all us prisoners, you know, into the woods out of the castle, because Americans were closing fast on the Hilditz area. And Colonel Todd said, there's no question of removing anybody. And he said, in the end, it was a matter of under duress, he had to. And I remember 11 o'clock at night, scuffling and rain and shouting, you know, rice, rice, and all the rest of it. And I'd like to do with these Germans. It sounded rather dramatic, nasty. We didn't want to see them go, they were nice people. We never know where they're going to go to. But anyway, it transpired that they went south towards Petersgarden.
Which is the prominent
area? Yes, prominent. Just learn it. It's 5 or 6 or 7. From this one, I'll check that out. Of course, it was a tremendous feeling. I wonder, will I take them out and shoot them or what? You know. Anyway, we got news through different methods. They'd landed up down, funny enough, at Laufen, which is the first camp we all went to. And I think they even went some to tip money. But Charlie Hampton was pretty ill, and he had to stay behind. But they looked up. In the end, they met some Americans coming up from Austria, and I think they were all rounded up and got home safely. But it was a dramatic time, and of course they were such a prize for Hitler. And if he hadn't got all this bunker business in Berlin, I think they'd have been on a rough wicket.
Can we go back to the day that you were describing? You said there was the first of your parades was 8:30. What followed after that?
Well, we had coffee, which was foul, acorn coffee. And we made up a meal of, we had about a fifth of a loaf of bread each, which is nothing really. And we had potatoes and bits and bobs, you know, but then the Red Cross parcels supplemented that, so that a mess of officers would consist of, say, 6 or 8 chaps. They were able to move around to different tables to break up the monotony of knowing your history and my history and his history, which could get very tricky because tempers rose and, you know, things weren't quite normal. And so that about midday there'd be another session of food, potatoes and everything. And that whole thing really revolved in another appeal, then another one at 6 or 7 o'clock, and one late night. I forget the actual times now, to be truthful. But the before day, and it was very exacting. You just get on your bunker. A lot of people slept. Some people slept half the prison of war life. They were lucky. I was one of them. I had a seat back a log there. And always have been able to up just recently. And this shortened the period. But it was difficult because they used to get varying views on whether windows should be closed or open. Stupid things like that.
And this was starting out?
Yes. Stop. Open the bloody window. No airing. Shut the bloody window. You know.
Did these things ever turn to blows?
No, not really. I can't say I saw anything of that. They got a bit ragged down then. But more or less sort of schoolboy stuff, you know. Certainly not amongst the senior officers. But she was subtle for that. But you see, I mentioned to you way back about the difference in, not class exactly, but in possibly grades of people. Now you had that very high grade of the prominente, more delightful, charming people, and you know, really high up in the land sort of business. Oh, I tell you who else was there. It'll come. They were very nice. Then you've got the next slice, people who were.
These would be high ranking officers.
Yes. And not all of them said high ranking, but in the right regiments once more. Or they thought they were. Well, they were. And you can't be fair.
So, in addition to your rank, also the hierarchy of regiments depend on the elite of.
Very much so. You see, I'll show you. That's where they landed up at 51st Hand Division, and they were a very strong contingent. Mostly delightful chaps. They went the long way around. In fact, he even mentions in there, as you may remember, that some British officers, depending where you're quartered, I was down in the Lens area, down that way, Arras, and they were pulled out of Castle, and then had to do the trip right up north of through Holland, and you know, the long trek has been murder. But on the whole, Kovitz was the evening meal was a thing. Each room, latterly anyway, got a 9 o'clock bulletin from the radio. The Germans didn't know that, or if they did, they didn't do anything about it. Don't think they did that. And there was complete silence, and the doors, all the stooges were out. Complete silence, and we heard some shocking news for 2.5 years. You know, there's things like Prince of Wales being blown up, home being lost, and they were running to tell you that. And once the freezing in Bismarck went down, it's another story. It was the evening meal when everyone got together. Then there was tremendous jealousy about the rations being served out meticulously. It's stupid when you look back on it, but I mean, absolutely, to the last crumb, people get absolutely hopping mad. But it's all worked out all right eventually. But you saw a different side of nature. I would say that the thing I learned as a prisoner of war is that you've got to look after yourself. Nobody else is interested in the slightest. Under the veneer of civilization. Maybe I'm too critical on that, but.
What kind of personality wasn't able to cope very well with this kind of life?
You see, when you look at it en masse, the chaps were caught for. Second lieutenants, first lieutenants, and captains, who were all young chaps. Some of them would be highly educated and would want things like music and the arts and that sort of thing. Well, that was a killer to them because it was a rough and tough business and they went into their shell a bit. And you'll see little groups who group together because of their interest in the arts of the world and not just the war town. And then we had, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to think. Quite a bit of gambling. I mentioned that, didn't I?
You said there was quite a bit of gambling, but you tell us the story of the gambler who lost quite a lot.
Well, he apparently lost a hell of a lot, and this is, of course, hearsay, and I can't vouch for this. But, I mean, we went home with the knowledge that this chap had sold out virtually because he'd have to pay his debt.
Do you feel that he would have been held to that?
Well, there is a big bunch. Actually, you might well do.
What were you gambling with? Was it money or IOUs?
IOUs, I think. I was never in that, so I can't say exactly, but
Was he frowned upon in prison camp, gambling? Has he been frowned upon in the army?
No, I think it was a means of keeping things on the even keel. But the couple of that was the fact that people paid bridge and it came out of their ears. And a tremendous amount of bridge played.